General Traumatic Family 1, 1963. I showed you one of the slides yesterday that had to do with the data obtained by analyzing some language samples. Here is another one. I'm just going to show you one more to give you a little feeling for some of the kind of information that you get in this way. These data are in the form of type token ratios. That is the ratio of the number of different words to total words, and these are the averages for 100-word segments. So this is the average TTR type token ratio for 100-word segments. It's the 100-word TTR. The samples are 3,000 words long from each individual. And the individuals were schizophrenic patients, mental hospital, and college students who were presumably normal. At least not. They were not schizophrenic, or as you can tell. There is an interesting differentiation of these two groups by means of this measure. These are the averages. And if you read the margin, you see that, let's say, here's the average for the students. So nearly 50%, wait a minute, all this up. So 80% or more of the patients fell below the average for the students. Now, the higher the score, the higher the ratio, that means the more different words per 100 words, the more highly differentiated the language used. And so these data tend to indicate, to establish the fact, or if you want to call it the probability, that patients suffering from schizophrenia tend to use a more restricted vocabulary. Their language is more rigid in that kind of meaning of the word rigid. And so far as this may be trusted as a dependable, valid finding, the implication would appear to be that there is something pretty unhealthy about a restricted kind of verbal output, that perhaps there is some advantage from the point of view of basic mental health in having a wide-ranging kind of language behavior, wide-ranging in terms of what you talk about and the put it in terms of the grammatical forms, the number of adjectives you use per noun. We also did some majors like that, and the normal students had more adjectives per noun, had more adverbs per verb. In other words, they made more qualifications in their statements. Their world was not so packed. Let's have the next slide. Another way to look at the rigidity of language behavior is in reference to the mood that is expressed. As think that's perhaps as good a way as any to put it, the dominant feeling, pessimism, optimism sort of thing, comes immediately to mind. This is also shown up in the kinds of associations that we make in response to work. There are persons who, how do you respond to names to people? You have a rather strong feeling against or for a name like Elmer or Alice or Mary. Do you like your own name very well, or don't you like your own name? Do you have a name that you don't use because you don't like it? The people like that. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about here. The reaction to a word, as though a word were somehow more substantial than a pattern of air vibrations or a pattern of dust marks on the blackboard or a pattern of ink lines on a piece of paper. The word association tests, which psychologists use in examining patients sometimes, tend to reveal some information about mental patients that is perhaps important in the hands of the right examiner. There are more or less conventional verbal responses to the words in the test, and then there are bizarre responses. There are individualistic responses which some people make to these words, which indicate some kind of a strong reaction, some sort of a persistence of an old experience, which is related to a word. And so you can have evaluational rigidity in this specific form. You respond to words a certain way. And I think this plays some part in prejudices. To some degree, people come to react to the word Jew, or the word Catholic, or the word Negro, or the word Mexican. And this is a curious sort of a thing, and some of the research, investigators have introduced words that are made up, essentially neologisms. In measuring attitudes toward various racial and ethnic groups, national groups, they'll introduce a word like Bulgarian. And they get reactions against it. A certain percentage of college students will indicate prejudice against Bulgarian. This is, I think, a very important fact. Pure verbal response, a pure response to a word. There's something for that individual about the word which associates for him with other words which he does not like, and so he makes this kind of a leap for the prejudice. I think many of the food dislikes which are persistent are probably in part, some degree, that would be hard to analyze out, but it's a kind of hypothesis that might be tested in a rough way, that part of the food dislike is a rather persistent sort of negative reaction to the word carrot, or to the word onion. The behavior of parents in naming babies, I think, should be subjected to much more research than it has been. I think it would be quite revealing. Where's the picture association? In the book, I tell about some other interesting examples of this. The one that interests me most is the study we did of the stutterers, from whom we obtain, in each case, a picture of the person. We ask them, who are the persons you find it hardest to talk to and easiest to talk to? And then we got pictures of these individuals without the stutterers knowing they were doing it. And then later, two or three weeks later or more, we asked the stutterer in each case to read a passage, and we noted the stuttered words. And then after the fifth reading, and this is done for a technical reason, I won't take time to go into it, but they read it five times. Then we introduced the picture of the person who was hard to read to, according to and immediately the number of stuttered words went up. Just as a picture. Now, I think that our reactions to pictures are rather mystical. And the applications for scholarships and admissions to colleges and applications for jobs, very often there's a request for a picture. I think one might be legitimately somewhat suspicious of this kind of request from a racial prejudice point of view. But aside from that, if there is no such ulterior motive, it must imply a kind of a symbolic magic on the part of the person who requests the picture. What you can tell about a person from looking at his picture is a little hard to make out. But apparently we have great confidence, or we have considerable confidence in what it is that we are able to get in the way of information about a person by looking at his photograph. We could go on with this, this is a fascinating subject, the practice of carrying a photograph with us, a photograph of a loved one. The practice of keeping your sweetheart's photograph on the dresser and so forth. This is interesting. I am not making any judgment about it, except that I am calling attention to it as a rather interesting kind of a semantic reaction. And it would be interesting to interview a few persons in depth in regard to what is their relationship to that photograph? Undated memories are another aspect of evaluation of rigidity. Hatreds and grudges and dislikes can last for years, long after the persons involved can remember very well what they were originally about. What is happening here is the individual, apparently, is still responding to, he's responding to a memory, whatever the memory consists of. Present imagery, things he tells himself at the moment now, as though it were still about what he thinks it was about. I'm sure to be wording this awkwardly, but he's identifying an actual experience at a given date with a memory of it, which is very different from the original experience. But he is reacting to them as though they were the same. So the memory is essentially timeless, has a validity through time, has nothing to do with what it is a memory of. One can almost make a technique on the basis of this. Technique of allocating hate, allocating dislike, allocating any kind of allocating fear allocating any kind of a disruptive, undesirable reaction to a date. You feel hostile toward your mother? Maybe some of you do. It'd be odd in sample of this size if there weren't quite a few. All right. Put a date on it. Mother, what date? Now go ahead and hate your head off. For that date. But don't confuse mother at that date with mother at this date. Don't hate the wrong person. Hate the right one. And then you won't hate the other one. This kind of allocation of your reaction to the appropriate date and place is a kind of thing to do that you can make a habit of. You can practice, and I think that it makes quite a difference in one's relationship to people. You see, there's a footnote to this. If you don't do this, then somehow there is suggested by our usual ethical and moral teachings that you should never hate, that you should be a paragon, that you should love everybody, and especially your mother, love her every minute of her life. Well, I suppose this would be mighty nice. I would have nothing against this in many cases. But it is a kind of ideal that is simply not attained by the great majority of persons. And if they feel they must attain it to be worthy, then they go around with guilt feelings. Seems to be much more constructive to me to be realistic about your limitations with regard to your ability to live up to some kind of ideal, but to allocate your failures. You're not failing all the time, it's only now and then. All right. So, you hate your mother as of April the 4th, 1961, and how you hate her. Well, go ahead, get it out of your system. It's harmless to her now. And the point of getting it out of your system that way is so you won't hate her now. That, whatever that was, it made you so hateful, is not going on now. Well, react to it. Go ahead. That's normal. It's all right. You don't have to feel guilty about that. You probably had good reason. Just don't make it last forever. Use a little dating and indexing. This evaluative labeling concept is a special way of talking about what we have talked about before in the behavior involved in assigning an individual to a category. And I'm calling attention with this term especially to those times when this is done and the category is heavily charged. It is an evaluative label, primarily. It is more important as an evaluative label than it is as a classification label. It is a rejection or some sort of an unindexed acceptance. And it is practice that we is almost the norm. Some of you do not have clinical interests. What I'm about to say has general application. One of the students in this course back in 15 years ago, who was a very good student in the course. She reacted to it with a great deal of industry and tried hard to learn from it. She went out into a certain kind of clinical work, and I had lost track of it. And one day I got a case report through channels. Turned out to be one of hers. She had been examining a child very difficult to understand. Those of you who are in speech pathology know how hard it is to talk meaningfully about the children who are variously called autistic or aphasic, or sometimes they're thought of as schizophrenic. But nobody seems able to work out a very good kind of terminology for talking about certain group of children. And this was one of those. And her report was simply thrilling, because she described what the child had done in a certain very well-described situation. There were no diagnostic terms in the whole report. It was rather long, 4 or 5 type of pages. And there were no diagnostic terms. It was just a description of what she had done in response to very well-described stimuli. And she had been ingenious in modifying the situation, and she described the modifications very clearly, and the altered response then of the girl to the modification. There was no evaluated labeling in this report. It was just neutral description. And the impact is something that I remember vividly. I'm used to reading reports. I read lots of clinical reports, and most of them are rather saddening to me from the point of view of the way they are written. They're written as though the clinician did not have a sensitivity to the individuality of the person that he's writing about. He calls him something. And then all too often appears to write about him as though he were that kind of person. I heard a paper read at a meeting I attended recently in which someone had gathered up a number of the cliches that you find in clinical reports, case reports. And, of course, it was kind of funny, but it was also terribly sad. Such phrases as, the child behaves like a typical autistic child. This in a clinical report. Behaves like a typical autistic child. How does a typical autistic child, what is an autistic child? This not only is vague and careless, but I think it is cruel. This harms the child who's being talked about this way. Once you have called a child brain damaged, this is one of the terms these days that's being used very, very carelessly, I think. And it amounts to evaluative labeling. The evaluation is much more important than the classification is. Once you have told a parent that her child is brain damaged, you have made it probably just impossible for that child ever again to have a normal relationship with his mother, unless she's a very remarkable woman who rejects you. Well, this isn't only a serious matter in a clinic. This is a serious matter at the dining table. In the dormitory, anywhere. It's the old expression that was in the exam, sticks and stones can hurt, can break my bones, but words can never hurt me, is very false. Words can hurt you much more than sticks and stones. Let's have the next try, then. Unless the panel wants to interrupt me. I want to spend the rest of our time today talking about, talking positively, about the semantics of the effective, constructive, creative use of language and semantics of personal development in these terms. I think much of it comes down to giving due attention to the order of abstracting. And as you proceed in any given instance, by now to use the common sense language, by getting the facts as best you can, before you begin to form any opinions about what happened, what the situation is, etc. And then you never form any hard and fast opinions. You never make up your mind for good about anybody or about anything. If you're going to be creative, original in the scientific field, you can't make up your mind for good what the facts really are and how they're to be interpreted. You can't find out what something you're going to call the right theory, and then stay with it the rest of your life. That is not the way to be creative. That is the opposite. And unfortunately, this tends to be encouraged a great deal by most education, I think. You're very conscious that in your more higher-order generalizations, you are talking about imaginables, supposables, beables, and you do have a sense of freedom there. You can make up new ones. There can be entirely new constructs, which you can then use to guide your observation. And that order, that the order represented in the diagram by that arrow. You keep this process of abstracting, keep it moving, keep it lively, don't stop. This takes certain forms in the arts and the sciences. And I have added another word, languages. I think you can be very creative. I would like to encourage you to read Gertrude Stein and to read James Joyce and to read E.E. Cummins. You may not like what you read, you may not get much out of it, but you will get a feel, I think, for the effort to be different with words, with language. And some of what you'll find in Gertrude Stein, for example, I think you will like very much. It, to me anyway, it, she says many things better than anybody else because she has achieved some kind of a new way of trying to represent experience. I've been especially impressed with talking about memory. How do you talk about your memories? How would you organize your autobiography? By years? Then would you write it like a layer cake? Would you be orderly in that? Well, if you were to read enough of Gertrude Stein, I don't think you would, because I think you would learn to prefer a sort of a mixture. a kind of a catapult, as it were. You dip down into your childhood and you bring something up and talk about it now. And about her writing, there is this kind of a then-nowness that I think is very superior to most of the historical writing that I see. The writers who try to be orderly and to say everything there is to say about 1908 before they say anything about 1909. That isn't the way you remember. That's not valid. I don't know very much about art. We're going to have some lectures here by Mr. David Novak, who I think does a good job of talking about what an artist does. But I would like to encourage a sympathetic reaction to the artist who is trying to be creative, to be original. Who is not just trying to paint another lemon in a vase. Who is trying to influence your vision. The revision of vision is, I think, to be encouraged. All art is abstract. Every picture is an abstraction, and I think that it's a great illusion of many people that some pictures are more like a barn than other pictures. None of them are the barn. They're all abstractions of the barn, or whatever it is. There's a barn in New Hampshire that has been painted a lot, is what I'm thinking of. And they're none of them like that barn. They're all abstractions. And if you're going to abstract, well, then I think you should be encouraged to be ingenious about it in any way that you can be. And I think there's a great deal to appreciate in and not just in what we call abstract art. I think some of what we call abstract art must have been painted by people who were not very conscious of abstracting. I really don't think they were abstracting. I think they just they were just careless, or hurried. I think some paintings that look very representational give evidence of a high consciousness of abstraction. I think we tend to make the issue along the wrong lines, as a rule, when we tend to draw it between the representationalists and the abstract painters. They're all abstract painters. And the basic question is, how good is the painter as an abstractor? And there's nothing he's supposed to do that is the right thing to do. Either, in either direction, as far as I can see. The point is to be trying deliberately to abstract in new ways. In science, this is done by the theorist. The theoretical physicist is not describing his observations, essentially. I mean, he makes some observations, but very often they seem to be very remote from what he's investigating. And he may have nothing to record but the setting on a dial. He may have, and there may be thousands of other settings
of other dials that he could record, but he doesn't. He is as much of an abstractionist as a Picasso. But he relates his abstractions, that he calls his theories, to these observations he makes in some orderly way. So that there is a predictability about the world for him. But the molecular theory of matter is an abstraction. Of course, I think the best theorists are those who know this and who deliberately go about trying to revise the abstractions they have achieved to date. Let's have the next slide. There are a few very fundamental notions, and I've talked too long about what I've talked about. One of the very most important ideas I have ever encountered is that of answerability of questions. I was pretty well along, almost through college, before I'd ever heard of such a thing as an unanswerable question. And so I was bothered, as I suppose all people are bothered, by not being able to answer certain questions like, what is the purpose of life? I thought all questions that were grammatical were supposed to be answered. Well, of course, it is terribly liberating to find out that there are questions that are not answerable. And so you just abandon them. Now, you don't have to abandon them. If you want to put in a long evening mulling about them, that's a form of recreation that might have something to be said for it. But you never know what it might possibly lead to. But I do think it is not very desirable to do this with the illusion that you're going to answer the question. But a question like, what is the purpose of life, can be heuristic. It can stimulate you to make some observations and to say some things that you might not otherwise say. But I think it would be not desirable to think you're going to answer the question. Not in that form. Because there are no instructions implied as to what you're to do in order to find the answer. Whenever you ask a question, you are obligated to provide the person who is to get the answer with the instructions he needs in order to know quite exactly where to go and what to do, what to observe, how, in order to get the answer. If you can't give these instructions, then you have asked a meaningless question, an unanswerable question. And we naively sometimes, I think, suppose that there must be somebody who knows the answer anyway, even though we don't know what the answer would be like if we saw it. Well, if you can conserve the time that you have been devoting to unanswerable questions, I think you can put it to much better use in many other ways. I wish there were time to go on to the rest of this, but maybe if you will just leave it up there, Augie, till anyone who wants to copy it at that time. Thank you.